We're going to be looking at Isaiah chapter 7, verses 1, 8 through 10. Remember, in 732 BC, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, king of Judah, through the prophet Isaiah, saying, "The Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel." And then Matthew 1:23 adds, which translates, means God with us. First of all, let's review. Where have we been? Again, I wanted to talk about the context. The context of this passage is very important to understand. Without understanding the context of this passage in which it was originally given, you're not going to really understand the depth and the richness of the passage that is applied to Christ in the New Testament. First, we saw that there was a fear of war coming, Isaiah 7, 1 through 2. And in those verses there in verse 1, we saw that there were three kings. There was King Uzziah, King Jotham, and King Ahaz, all from the tribe of Judah, the line of David. King Uzziah, was he a good king or a bad king? Thumbs up or down? We have thumbs down. Over here we have thumbs down. What about over here? We have a thumbs up. Okay, he was a good king. Apparently, I wasn't emphasizing this enough last week. Melinda said it was going too fast, and she didn't get to write everything down. But you want to write something down beside King Uzziah? He was a good king, right? He ruled for 52 years, and he did what was right in the sight of God. Because of that, he became very strong. However, there was one thing that he failed to do throughout his reign, was that he failed to remove the high places. High places were, again, places where people would go on top of some hill or mountain and offer sacrifices. Now, high places weren't always wrong. God had accepted sacrifices from Abraham, Jacob, and so forth on these high places. But at the time, people had entered into the land, and God had established a place for them to come and offer sacrifices, which was during the period of the judges in Shiloh, and then later in Jerusalem on Mount Zion. Only those places were where people were supposed to come and offer sacrifices and burn incense and so forth before God. Sometimes the high places are people established and they brought sacrifices. They sacrifices to the Lord, and other times they sacrifice to other gods. But either way, whether they were sacrificing to the Lord or sacrificing to other gods, they were strictly prohibited under the law. All right, King Jotham, was he a good king or a bad king? Thumbs up or down? We have a two thumbs up over here. Thumbs up. Down? All right, he was a good king. Thumbs up. Now, he was also mighty. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord. Because of that, the Lord continued to strengthen his kingdom. But he did not remove the high places like his father Uzziah, and the people continued to act corruptly. Now, Jim also asked, why did Uzziah and Jotham not tear down the high places? Later on, we find out that Hezekiah and Josiah did. Why didn't they tear down the high places? They were afraid of the people. The people weren't afraid of the king as much as the king was afraid of the people. So he tolerated their false religion. I was wondering, well, who was responsible for enforcing the law during the time? Anybody know? Who were the law enforcers? Yeah, the Levites and the priests. They were supposed to be the ones that were to enforce the law, right? They were the guardians of the law and the temple and so forth. In fact, a lot of times, it was the Levites, the priests, who were on the high places offering the sacrifices. So they themselves were in violation of the law. Okay, remember, God had commanded Israel in the law to destroy all the high places of the Canaanites. The Canaanites had high places. God said, when Joshua come in there, destroy all of their high places. And then he also warned them that if they erected their own high places, that he would punish them, lay waste their cities, and make the land desolate, according to Leviticus 26, 27 through 32. And it was at the end of Jotham's reign that we read this. In those days, the Lord began to send Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah because of the corruption of the people and the continual practice of worshiping and sacrificing to either the right God, Yahweh, or to Baals at the high places. All right, King Ahaz, was he a good king or a bad king? Boo, he was a bad king. He was very, very bad. All right, he was an idolater. He made molten images to Baal, which were the gods of the Canaanites. He began to follow and do the things that the northern tribe was doing. Not only that, he burned his sons in fire. He practiced human sacrifice. And not only did he tolerate the high places, but he would go to these high places himself and offer incense and sacrifice there. And because of that, he provoked the Lord to anger. And he brought about a lack of restraint in Judah, and he was very unfaithful. And there are other things that he did. You'll find those in 2 Chronicles chapter 28, and also in 2 Kings chapter 16. It was at this time that King Aram and the king of Ephraim went up to Jerusalem to wage war against it. Now, last week we talked about the fact that this is from Isaiah chapter 7, verse 1 and 2. And this is not the first time that they had come up against King Ahaz in Judah. The first time they had come up, they defeated Judah and slaughtered 120,000 Judean soldiers, took 200,000 slaves and captive, women and children, but later they returned them. So this is now the second time they come up to Jerusalem, and this time they say, we're not only going to overthrow you, we're going to depose you, King Ahaz, and we're going to set up someone else in your place. And as a result of that, it says that when it was reported to the house of David, that as Ahaz's heart and the hearts of the people shook as the trees of the forest shake the wind. Now you see a map here. Here's Israel. There's Jerusalem, the capital of Judah. There's little Ahaz, right there in Jerusalem. To the north, up in this area, was Israel. They made a pact here with Syria, and they were invading Judah and attempting to overthrow. Now you see that over here in Iraq, we have Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, and then down here in Babylon. Syria and Israel hoped to overthrow Judah to make them stronger so that they could then fight Assyria. It's at this time now that King Ahaz sends messengers to the king in Assyria, sends some gifts, and asks him for help. Help! Send your army against my enemies, he tells them. But it was at this time that now the Lord announces his plan. Ahaz had his plan, now God is going to have his plan. The Lord sends the prophet Isaiah to tell King Ahaz to take care, be calm, and have no fear. In fact, Ahaz really had no reason to fear the nations if, in fact, he trusted the Lord, knew his word, and trusted his word. Remember back what God had said to King David back in 2 Samuel 7? This was called the Davidic covenant. What did he say to David? Your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. In other words, if Ahaz knew of this covenant, maybe he knew of it, probably did, but he didn't believe in it, because if he did believe in it, then he would have nothing to fear. When the two kings came against him and threatened to depose him and to wipe out his whole family in the line of David, he should have went back to what God had said. There will always be someone in physical line of David to reign and this will last forever. So he had nothing really to fear. God's plan surrounds three children. The three children were Sherub Jashub, which means a remnant shall return or remain, Emmanuel, God with us, and Maha Shala Hasbaz, which means quick to the spoil or quick to the plunder. First thing we saw last week, the sign of Sherub Jashub, a remnant will return. This sign is a double-sided sign. It also is positive and negative. All of these signs, in fact, are. Sherub Jashub means a remnant shall return. It was both positive and negative sign to Ahaz. The child who had been named before these coming events foresaw a destruction which would leave but a remnant, that is, a small number of people. This also meant only a remnant, not total annihilation. When Isaiah comes to talk to King Ahaz, he brings his son with him. Good morning, King Ahaz, out here on the pool, planning your schemes to defend Jerusalem. Oh, here, meet my son. A remnant shall return. Oh, a remnant shall return? What does that mean? That doesn't sound too good. Only a small remnant are going to remain here. But, on the other hand, there will be someone still here. There's not going to be total annihilation and extermination. So it's entirely possible that Ahaz now dreaded total eradication. To that, Isaiah's son says, no, there will be a remnant of Judah and the house of David preserved from destruction. And as history works its way out, this is exactly what happens. Now, also, Ahaz should have known that even though God had said that I will establish my throne forever, and I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me, he should have known this also, that when someone in the line of David commits iniquity, God said, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. That's also from the Davidic covenant in 2 Samuel 7. Now we come to the sign of Emmanuel, God with us. Isaiah 7, 10 through 17. Let's look at some couple things here in depth in verse 14, where it says, and the Lord himself will give you a sign. Now notice it is in your translations. You open your Bible. No matter what version you have, hopefully, you'll notice here that it's capital L, small, not capital O-R-D, but O-R-D. That is an indication that that's the Hebrew word Adonai, which means sovereign master. This is to emphasize the fact that it is, who is speaking? It is the sovereign, the one who's in control. Not Ahaz, not King Assyria, not the nations. It is the Lord. It is the sovereign master who is in control. And you notice that it's a contrast with the other Lord, which is capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. When you see that, it's referring to Yahweh, I am, the eternal one. And also notice it's, I will give you. Who is he speaking to? He's speaking to Ahaz. I'm giving you Ahaz a sign. He's also given it to Judah, but it also goes beyond that, as we'll see, and applies to the whole world. This is a sign initially given to King Ahaz, but it also applies to us as well. Now notice, what a sign. He's going to give you a sign. Now, a sign is something that points to or represents something larger than itself. A sign was given many times to strengthen one's faith in order to give evidence to what God said was going to come true. If you notice in Exodus 7:3, it says there that God multiplied miraculous signs and wonders in Egypt as mighty acts of judgment. The plagues were a sign of judgment to the Egyptians and a sign also of deliverance to Israel. Let me look up Exodus chapter 8. verses 22 and 23. 8:22. This is about the flies. God speaking to Moses, he said, "But on that day I will set apart the land of Goshen." That's where the Israelites were living in Egypt at the time of their slavery, "where my people are living, so that no swarms of insects will be there, in order that they may know that I am the Lord and in the midst of the land. And I will put a division between my people and your people. Tomorrow the sign shall occur." In other words, the flies came to Egypt, but they only came upon the Egyptians, but they didn't come upon the Israelites. That was a sign that God was with Israel for deliverance, but he was also with the flies as a judgment upon the Egyptians. So a sign can be a twofold thing. Now we come to the word, "I will give a sign, behold, a virgin will be with child." Now in the original Hebrew, the meaning of this word means a young woman of marriageable age, or a sexually mature woman, but unmarried young woman. Now, in the New Testament, it's even more specific. Now, I want to emphasize here that in Ahaz's day, it only means that the young woman was a virgin at the time this prophecy was given, not that she remained so at the child's birth, as it was with Mary. Understand what I'm saying here? Don't get confused. So when Isaiah says there's going to be a woman who's presently a virgin, who later conceive, not by a miraculously, but by normal conception, and then have a child, and as a result, things will happen. But then the New Testament takes this and expands it. Again, the sign of Emmanuel, God with us, is both positive and negative. Read what the commentary Oswald said. "The presence of a transient and holy God with us well mean we or woe together, to the extent that we are dependent upon him. His presence results in blessing. But to the extent that we refuse to depend on him, his presence is an embarrassment and a curse. Both realities are implicit in his presence. Hope and judgment are tightly intertwined. The reality of God's presence with his people can portend joy or sorrow at the same time, depending upon the people's character." The sign of Emmanuel also has a double fulfillment. This is a two-folded sign, all of these signs, actually, of these three children. The primary reference was to the coming Messiah. The initial or secondary reference was during Ahaz's lifetime. Let me illustrate this with this kind of a crude way of doing it, with the mountains. Here we have Isaiah, or people living in the time of Ahaz's day, and he's looking at the prophecy. All he sees is the application of it here in 730 or 729 BC. However, he does not see the secondary application or the second fulfillment of it. From his perspective, all he can see is this mountain. He can't see like this other mountain behind him. He can't see the second fulfillment. All he sees is what's going to happen in his lifetime. He doesn't see the gap. You can see this throughout, especially in Isaiah and throughout the Old Testament. This is how a lot of times a prophecy is fulfilled. It's not always fulfilled at one time. In Isaiah chapter 61, where Jesus comes to Nazareth, he quotes that passage, and he quotes about the coming Messiah. But he stops at a certain point where it says about the wrath of God coming. He stops there because when he came the first time, he wasn't bringing God's wrath upon the nation. That's part of the second coming. So, a lot of ways, you could say there's three fulfillments of many of these passages. We see in 730 BC, there's an initial fulfillment. Then some of the fulfillment will occur at his first coming, but yet there's going to be a second coming in which the rest of it's going to be fulfilled. A lot of times we say, well, how do we know what's what's being fulfilled and what has not been fulfilled. Where we say that certain things are going to be fulfilled because, well, Christ didn't fulfill those at the first time. So this is how prophecy works. Now let's look at who is this child. First of all, Oswald says it is extremely difficult to identify the child of Ahaz's time. And I struggled with this. And I came up with, commentators and theologians and Bible scholars have come up with a couple possibilities. The possibility number one is that the child spoken of is the son of Ahaz. And some suggest that it was King Ahaz's son Hezekiah. So therefore, the virgin he's speaking of is Ahaz's wife. The problem with this view is, of course, is that Ahaz already had several children. Therefore, Ahaz's wife was certainly not a virgin or a young woman of unmarriageable age. She was already married. So I guess we can probably scratch that one off. Also, we could mention that Hezekiah, if he was 25 when he ascended to the throne in 1516, he would have been 6 years old at the time that this prophecy was given by Isaiah. The second possibility is the child born and the virgin, young woman, is unknown to us, but it was known to both Ahaz and Isaiah. In other words, when Isaiah is standing there and he says, "Behold, a virgin shall have a child," he's saying, "This woman over here." But he doesn't tell us who it is. Isaiah and Ahaz know who the woman is and who the child's going to be, but we don't know. A lot of people say, well, who cares? Who cares who this child was in Ahaz's time? Because what's really significant is who it relates to in the ultimate fulfillment, that is Jesus Christ. So they really don't spend much time thinking about who this the original prophecy was about. So they let's just focus on the ultimate fulfillment and not care about this other point. But the third possibility is this. The child is the son of Isaiah, and the virgin is Isaiah's wife. The problem with this, obviously, is, again, Isaiah already had a son. Remember? Sheriff Joseph. Therefore, Isaiah's wife would not be a virgin. He's already married. He's not referring to about an unmarried woman. However, there's a solution to this. Even though it's not mentioned in Scripture, we'd have to assume this, that Isaiah's first wife has died, and the virgin is a young woman of marriageable age, soon to be his second wife. So the son born of a virgin is the same son born to the prophetess in chapter 8, verse 3. And that's why I want to do a comparison here, because I want to emphasize the fact that Emmanuel and Mahasharahasbaz are one and the same. They're the same child born of the same mother. And we can see this by comparing the two prophecies. Isaiah chapter 7, verses 14 through 16. The sign of Emmanuel and the sign of Mahasharahasbaz, found in Isaiah 8, 1 through 4. In Isaiah 7, it says, "A virgin will be with child and bear a son." And then it says in chapter 8, Isaiah says, "I approached the prophet, she conceived and gave birth to a son. She will call his name Emmanuel. Then the Lord said to me, name him Mahasharahasbaz. For before the boy will know to refuse evil and choose good, before the boy knows how to cry out father and mother." And then lastly, the result, "The land whose the two kings you dread will be forsaken. And then the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria." So you see the comparison. That's the solution to this problem of who the child is to say that Emmanuel, Mahasharahasbaz are one and the same. The sign of Emmanuel and Mahasharahasbaz ends with the same results, desolation and deportation. There's a double implication of hope and confidence in impending doom. The same agency that's going to plunder and depopulate Syria and bring rejoicing in Judah is about to bring destruction and deportation upon Judah and sorrow is about to come upon Judah. Assyria now invades Judah. At this point, as soon as Assyria comes in and destroys Syria and Ephraim, there's great rejoicing in Judah. Our enemies have been destroyed. Ahaz is a great king. Look what he has done. But what happens? It backfires on them. They don't just stop there. They come and say, we want Judah too. So they come and they surround Judah. So now, God is with us. God is with us is the king of Assyria. We see in Isaiah chapter 7, verses 18 through 25, we see Assyria as a razor. It says it will come about in that day, the Lord will whistle for the fly that is in the remotest parts of the rivers of Egypt and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. They will all come and settle on the steep ravines and on the ledges of the cliffs and all the thorn bushes and on all the watering places. In that day, the Lord will shave with a razor hired with regions beyond the Euphrates, that is the king of Assyria, and the head of the hair of the legs, and it will also remove the beard. Now it came about in that day that a man will keep alive a heifer and a pair of sheep, and it will happen that because of his abundance of milk and produce, he will eat curds, for everything that is left behind the land will eat curds and honey. That part's referring to the remnant that's remained. The small group of people that remain after Assyria is done with them, they'll have plenty to eat because there's only a few people left. But then he says, and in it will come about in that day that every place where there used to be 1,000 vines and vineyards valued at thousands of shekels of silver will become briars and thorns. People will come there with bows and arrows because of the land will be with briars and thorns. As for all the hills which used to be cultivated with a hoe, you will not go there for fear of the briars and thorns, but they will become a place of pasturing oxen and for sheep to trample. So what is the result? When Assyria comes in, they depose and they destroy not only Samaria and Syria, but they come and they surround Jerusalem and they devastate the land to the point where the vineyards, once there were great hills of great vineyards, and they were going to be turned into briar patches and thorn bushes. And the farmland is going to be turned into nothing but hunting ground. Wild animals are going to come in and take over because all of the fences and everything that people that were there were gone. We also see a second prophecy about this, Assyria as a flood, in Isaiah chapter 8, verses 5 through 10. Again, the Lord spoke to me, saying further, inasmuch as these people have rejected the gentle flowing waters of Shiloh, and rejoice in Rezin and the son of Remaliah, now therefore, behold, the Lord is about to bring on them a strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates, even the king of Assyria, and all his glory. And it will rise up over all its channels and go over all its banks. Then it will sweep on into Judah, and it will overflow and pass through. It will reach even to the neck. And the spread of the wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. Be broken, O people, be shattered, and give ear, O remote places of the earth. Gird yourself, yet be shattered. Gird yourself, yet be shattered. Devise a plan, O Ahaz, but it will be thwarted. State a proposal, but it will not stand, for God is with us. What was the result of Assyria invading Judah? Judah will be up to their neck in Assyrians. They'll be completely surrounded. Nowhere to go. Another way to say it is Judah will be up to their neck with God. God has brought the Assyrians there to punish Judah for their sins. And notice, it is the sovereign Lord who brings judgment. God commissioned Assyria as the rod of his anger against Judah. Look at Isaiah 10, verses 5 and 6. He says, woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hands is my indignation. I send it against a godless nation, commissioned it against the people of my fury to capture booty and to seize plunder and to trample down like mud in the streets. God has brought quick to the plunder to ravage the land. However, Assyria should also have been cautious, because when he says the Lord is finished with Judah, he's going to punish Syria. Chapter 10, verse 12 says, "So it will be that when the Lord has completed all of his work with Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness." All right, let's conclude this and wrap it up and make some application out of it. The initial fulfillment of the sign was not the ultimate fulfillment. In other words, don't think that there's just this one sign, that it refers to just one thing. It refers to two things. And also not think that the ultimate fulfillment is the only thing, that there's no significance to the initial fulfillment that God promised to Ahaz in his time. The ultimate fulfillment, we find, is found in a person named Jesus, for he will save. God is with us and will be with us, not merely in the development of history and in the nations, in the way, in providence and ways he works in the world, but somehow he will be with us as a person. We read in Matthew 21, chapter 1, verse 21-23, "She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins." This was in order to fulfill the sign of Emmanuel, God with us. And we know that the Word became flesh, and he dwelt among us. And we have what happened in the rest of the New Testament, which we aren't going to go into depth here, but I'll summarize it. He came, he died, rose again, he secured salvation for all who believe, and ascended into the heavens. And now he is and is promised to return. For those who believe in him, he has given us his Spirit, for he said, "I am with you always." So God's presence is still a blessing, but it's only a blessing to those who do what is right in the sight of the Lord. To those who believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and if you live it out, love one another just as he commanded, it's a blessing. But if we don't fulfill it, then his presence, God with us, can be a terror to those who don't. See the book of Hebrews. What all those six warnings that he gives throughout the book is about people who don't fulfill their trust in God. All right, lastly, were God's people saved? In Ahaz's day, Assyrians withdrew from Judah and marched to Babylon after hearing of disturbances in the land. I'd wondered. Isaiah just kind of stops and doesn't say, well, what happened? After Assyria comes and he surrounds Jerusalem, they're up the neck with Assyrians, with God with us, what happens after that? Well, they withdrew. And I had to go into a Bible encyclopedia and found out that the king of Assyria hears of something going on over in Babylon, and he has to withdraw and go back and deal with that. Ahaz was left there, and he ruled for another 10 years or so. But he ruled with total panic, because at any time, Syria could come back. The land had been already desolated, and so God had bring punishment upon him. Later, Hezekiah had to deal with the Syrians as well. What about in Jesus' day? What happened to him? The Romans came and destroyed Jerusalem and Judea and made slaves out of the remaining inhabitants. In our day, the Jews have returned, and they now live in Judah, but they don't live securely. They are under constant threat of invasion, constant threat of annihilation. They're always worried about what's going on in Iran. They're building a bomb. Iran's talking with North Korea. North Korea's sending off missiles. Will they send one over to Israel, destroy God's people? Will that happen? Will God's people be saved? I got this from reading Zane Hodge's book on the end times. And he says, in the end times, that the one world ruler, not the Antichrist, but the one world ruler is also called, is known as the King of the North. And in Micah 5:5, he's known as the Assyrian. It says in the end times the king of the north will invade Israel, the Assyrian, the one world ruler. And it's going to be a child born in Bethlehem that will deliver Israel from the Assyrian at the time. Look at Micah chapter 5, verses 2 through 6. He says, "But as for you, Bethlehem, too little to be among the clans of Judah, for you one will go forth to me to be ruler in Israel. His going forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. Therefore, he will give them up until the time when she who is in the labor has borne a child. Then the remainder of his brethren will return to the sons of Israel." Verse 4. This is talking about the second coming. And we had the first coming, now the second coming. "And he will arise, shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of his name, and the Lord his God. And they will remain, the Israel will remain, because at that time he will be great." Verse 5. "This one will be our peace when the Assyrian invades our land." In other words, when the king of the north, the one world ruler, invades the land, when he tramples on our citadels, our strongholds, then we will rise against him. Seven shepherds and eight leaders of men, they will shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword, with the land of Nimrod at its entrance. And he will deliver us, the one born as a child, the great Emmanuel, God with us. He will deliver us from the Assyrian when he attacks our land and when he tramples our territory. So, we see the sign of Emmanuel had a short-term fulfillment, had a fulfillment in Jesus' day, and it's still yet to be fulfilled in the future. When this child, who was born in a lowly town of Bethlehem, will rise up to be the Savior of the world and Judah. And at that time, all Israel will be saved.